Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we examine the role and the duties of the U.S. Attorney General. For whom does and should the Attorney General work? And what's behind the growing control of the Department of Justice by the presidency? Doug Becker explores these questions.
I'm Doug Becker. Merrick Garland has just been confirmed as President Joseph Biden's Attorney General. This office and the Department of Justice has been a focal point of controversy in previous years. In particular, the tenures of President Donald Trump's attorneys general, Jeff Sessions and William Barr, have raised critical issues on the proper relationship between the Department of Justice and the presidency. On today's show, we will examine this relationship, the expectation and necessity of independence out of the office, and how this relationship will likely proceed in light of the developments of these recent years. Our guest is Cornell Clayton. He is the C.O. Johnson Distinguished Professor of Government and Director of the Thomas S. Foley Institute for Public Policy and Public Service at Washington State University. He's the author of The Politics of Justice, Attorney General, and the Making of Government Legal Policy. Thank you very much, Professor Clayton, for joining us. My first question is a deceptively simple one. Who does the Attorney General work for?
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invitation to be with you today. So that's a very tough question to answer. I guess the easy answer is the Attorney General works for the American people. Of course, the real question I think you're asking gets at questions about separation of powers. And should we think of the Attorney General primarily as an executive branch officer in the same way we think of as other executive branch cabinet members and their obligations to the president? Or should we think of the Attorney General as more autonomous from direct presidential control, maybe having special obligations to the courts or to Congress? And the answer to that question, I think, has changed over time. The way the framers of the Constitution and the framers of the Judiciary Act of 1789, which created the Attorney General's office, I think thought about the role of the Attorney General very differently than we do today. And that's a long story. It's a long history about how that the position has evolved over time.
I know there's been quite a bit of an emphasis in recent years, and in particular with President Trump and the question of independence of the Attorney General and who exactly does he or she work for. But this question certainly predates the presidency of Donald Trump. What have been some of the issues that have been raised recently that called into question some of the independence of the Attorney General prior to the 2016 election?
Oh, prior to the Trump administration? Mm-hmm. Well, clearly, you know, under the George W. Bush's administration, for instance, there was a lot of criticism of the Justice Department's role in the war on terror, especially some of the opinions that came out of the OLC's office and some of the litigation positions taken by the Solicitor General that seemed to stretch the law as it was at the time and took positions that was contrary to established principles of law. You know, if you go back further, there was a lot of criticism during the Reagan administration of what Attorney General Meese did, changing a lot of the litigating positions of the Department of Justice and adopting a very aggressive stance towards constitutional interpretation. Prior to that, of course, the Nixon administration was very controversial, I think for different reasons. Most of them having to do with whether or not the Justice Department was going to be a watchdog over the president who was acting corruptly. And you can go back. I mean, in the Eisenhower administration, there was problems with corruption in the Department of Justice. In the Harding administration, problems with Teapot Dome scandal involved the Attorney General. So these controversies have been off and on throughout the history of the office, but in particular in the 20th century. And I think one of the things to understand is why the Department of Justice and the Attorney General have become more controversial on a more regular basis in recent decades is as a result of a number of broader institutional developments. And one of those is simply, the growth of the administrative state and the role that the Department of Justice has in, because it's the chief litigator for the federal government, it controls the litigating positions of all federal agencies. So it has a chokehold on regulatory decision-making in lots of ways. Also because increasingly we have begun to, our courts have become much more important policymakers over the last half century. And so operating right at the nexus between the executive branch and the courts, the Attorney General and the Department of Justice are now critical policymaking roles. And so that's why they've become increasingly more controversial in terms of their policymaking roles, in addition to these questions about corruption, which is a more perennial problem that you see with respect to the Attorney General and the Justice Department.
Now, that question of corruption, there seems to be an endemic tension here then, because since the Attorney General is nominated by the president can presumably fire the Attorney General as a member of his or her cabinet. The expectation that the Attorney General could investigate other areas of the executive branch, doesn't that create an inherent conflict of interest? And so is it most proper that the Attorney General as a member of the executive be the watchdog over another executive, or is that a role that probably should be played, more, for instance, by the legislative branch, by a congressional oversight of the executive?
This is a problem, again, it's been a perennial problem. It came to a head in the aftermath of Watergate and Nixon's resignation, and the politicization of the Department of Justice took place then. There was a set of hearings. Sam Irvine headed up the hearings back then about what to do about this controversy and the controversy more generally about what is the appropriate role that the president has in directing the general policies of the Department of Justice. So again, I want to separate out these two questions. One is this more narrow question of corruption and prosecution of corruption within the administration and who should do that. And the second question is, what's the general relationship between the administration's policies and the Department of Justice policies? And the Irvine committees took on both those questions. In the end, they decided and they considered legislation that would have made the Attorney General and the Department of Justice an independent agency. They would have, much like heads of independent agencies like the FTC or the SEC, they would have made the Attorney General appointed to a fixed term of office, not removable by the president, thus buffering him from political control, and all the authorities of the Attorney General, which means the entire Department of Justice. They rejected that reform, but in the end, in 1978, they adopted a more narrow reform in the Ethics in Government Act, and that created the so-called Independent Counsel's Office, which operated up until 1999, by the way. The Independent Counsel's Office got at that more narrow problem of what happens when you have credible evidence of misconduct by people high up in the administration and who can prosecute them in a credible way, free from conflict of interest. And the Independent Counsel statute aimed at getting at that precise issue. In a case called Morrison versus Olson in 1988, the Supreme Court upheld that office against the constitutional challenge that you couldn't remove prosecution from direct presidential control. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Rehnquist at the time, a strong advocate of executive branch power, nevertheless said that the independent counsel statute was constitutional because it was very narrowly tailored and it got at this question of conflict of interest. And that the key question was not whether the prosecution is an executive function, thus should be controlled by the president, but rather the key question was whether you could remove that very narrow function from direct presidential control and not impede the president's constitutional duties and obligations. And the court said you could. So they upheld the independent counsel statute. Now, of course, that doesn't mean it was good policy, and because independent counsels tended to take on their own life once they were appointed. We had that whole fiasco with Ken Starr and the investigation of Monica Lewinsky it went on forever. There was a bipartisan agreement that the independent counsel mechanism wasn't working well. So the act was not reauthorized in 1999. And so the independent counsel mechanism went away. It was replaced by a different reform called the special counsel provisions. There are simply policies within the Department of Justice that try to provide some independence to special counsels, but they are still under the direct control of the Attorney General.
Now, I know in a piece that you had written that critiqued, at the time, Attorney General Barr, you had cited some of Barr's comments about the lack of independence of the Attorney General and the designation of the Attorney General's office as really being under the president's purvey. And you referenced something called unitary executive theory. First of all, what is unitary executive theory, and how popular is it when considering this question of the independence of the Attorney General?
Yeah, the unitary executive theory is an idea that it's actually not that old. It's been around for several decades now. It has been propounded primarily by conservative legal scholars and Justice Department officials, but sometimes you also see it in Democratic administrations as well being argued. The argument is that because the Constitution vests all executive power in the president, that any function, any duty, any power that we categorize as executive must be under the direct control of the president, and that you can't have any kind of autonomy or independence from presidential control if you're performing executive functions. And so that's the unitary executive branch theory. Again, I think it's been rejected by the Supreme Court on numerous occasions. With respect to the Department of Justice in particular, it was rejected in U.S. versus Nixon, and also in Morrison versus Olson, the case I just talked about. You know, one of the interesting things in U.S. versus Nixon, you know, we think about that case primarily because the court for the first time recognized the constitutional idea of executive privilege. And that's how we normally think of U.S. v. Nixon. But there was a jurisdictional threshold question in that case, which is very important. The attorneys for Richard Nixon argued that the case should be dismissed by the court. In fact, argued it couldn't even be heard by the courts because the special prosecutor in that case, Leon Jaworski, was a member of the executive branch. And as a member of the executive branch, the case was essentially an interbranch conflict. It was essentially President of the United States versus President of the United States, and the courts can't intervene in an interbranch conflict. That was their jurisdictional argument. The Supreme Court rejected that argument and said basically that Congress can, under statute, create some autonomy, some independence from presidential control of executive branch functions. And to the extent they've vested that authority in the Attorney General, and the Attorney General then created some independence for the independent counsel or the special prosecutor in that case, then the president couldn't object to being sued by an executive branch official. So this idea of executive, this unitary executive theory has been rejected in recent years by the Supreme Court. But if you went back, I think, to the founding period or the early period in the Republic, that the whole idea would have been anathema, I think, to the founders. I think they broadly saw the executive power as a power of management and enforcement of laws created by Congress, and that Congress had a tremendous amount of authority to control how laws would be enforced. And the president's duties were to carry out what Congress was directing the president to do, so long as those commands were constitutional. But, the powers of the executive branch have grown enormously, especially in the 20th century. And so that's a whole different story about the growth of presidential power vis-a-vis Congress we could talk about later.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the independence of the Attorney General's Office in the Department of Justice with Cornell Clayton of Washington State University. He is the author of The Politics of Justice, Attorney Generals, and the Making of Government Legal Policy. Thank you. Now, Professor Clayton, you had highlighted examples of this tension, this relationship between an independent attorney general and the presidency. I noted that each of those examples, Harding, Eisenhower, Nixon, Bush, and then certainly Donald Trump, are all Republicans. And so is this tension more salient with Republican administrations? Or put differently, is this really a partisan question where the question about the independence of the Department of Justice is really much more of an issue when we have Republican presidents and Democratic presidents?
No, there's certainly been corruption scandals under Democratic presidents. There was a lot of criticism of Eric Holder, for instance, in the Obama administration for being too solicitous to the president's power that Obama was exercising. There have been criticisms of Bobby Kennedy was appointed by Robert Kennedy. That was seen as a tremendous violation of the norms governing the Department of Justice. He was seen as somebody who was unqualified, and not only there was questions about nepotism there, and him being too solicitous to President Kennedy. So that this is not necessarily a partisan issue. I do think that in recent decades, Republican justice departments and attorneys general get in more. They are more controversial because they are more likely to accept this unitary theory of executive power. And therefore, these administrations appoint attorneys general who have a different view about their relationship to the president in general. And Barr laid that out perfectly in many of his comments. In one of his more controversial speeches, he basically said, look, I work for the president. That's my job. Anybody who says otherwise, it's nonsense, because everything I do is an executive function and the president directs everything I do. And I think increasingly Republicans, because they accept this unitary theory of the executive, they appoint attorneys general and Justice Department officials who have that view of their relationship to the White House. And they behave that way. On the other hand, I think Democrats are less likely to think that's the role the Department of Justice should be playing with respect to the White House. They are more likely to appoint people who have a sense of independence and autonomy, that there's some obligation to the courts, the Congress, in addition to the executive branch. And I think Merrick Garland exemplifies that perfectly. I mean, one of the things that happened in the wake of Watergate was not just these statutory reforms, legal efforts to safeguard the Department of Justice, but there's this whole effort to create new norms. And one of the norms, Jimmy Carter pledged, for instance, to appoint somebody who would be apolitical, with an apolitical background, to the Department of Justice. And of course he did. He appointed Griffin Bell, who was a former federal judge. Gerald Ford likewise appointed Edward Levy, who had been a law professor, a law dean, the president of Chicago Law School for 30 years, was seen as an apolitical character, not someone who had been involved in partisanship and partisan administrations in the past. And I think you see that again now with Merrick Garland, for instance, this idea of you should seek somebody who has a judicial background, who sees their role as a little more autonomous than other members of the executive branch from direct presidential control. Republicans, I think, are less likely to think about the attorney general in those terms. And so I think that's the difference.
Now, we've laid out kind of the historical trends and, try to put this relationship in this historical context, and doing so to ask a question that I think first and foremost on my mind. Was the Trump administration's Department of Justice unique, perhaps more egregious, in this expectation of a lack of independence from the Justice Department, or being much more acquiescent to the president's wishes than previous administrations? Is it fair to say that Jeff Sessions and William Barr were both unique, perhaps less independent than previous attorneys general?
I mean, there have been other attorney generals who have felt very close to the president. You know, Edwin Meese certainly felt that way to Ronald Reagan, for instance. There's no question. John Mitchell felt that way to Richard Nixon. Bobby Kennedy felt that way to his brother, right? So I think there is a difference with the Trump administration. And from my perspective, a lot of this has to do with much broader institutional trends taking place. There are two separate sets of institutional developments that came together, particularly in the Trump administration, that I think are problematic for the Department of Justice. One is this one I've already talked about, and this is the idea of accumulation of power in the executive branch, which has been going on since at least the 1930s. The executive branch, the presidency is becoming more and more powerful vis-a-vis Congress. And so that's one development that's taking place. There's another development that's more recent, and that is the growing autonomy of the president from party control and congressional control. So in the modern administrative state, when that started to develop, progressives overcame the problem of this very powerful administrative regulatory bureaucracy by putting under presidential control. But the assumption was presidents could be controlled by Congress through the party mechanism. Parties could pick presidents, could discipline presidents. And essentially, that's exactly what you had with Richard Nixon. The reason Richard Nixon had to leave office is because his own party, his own congressional party, came to him and said, your time is up. The problem is, since at least the 1990s, as a result of changes in the way we fund our campaigns particularly, is presidents have become increasingly autonomous from party control, meaning increasingly autonomous from congressional control. Congress can't stand up to the president. The congressional party can't stand up to the president any longer. And so what you're getting is two separate trends coming together. One is the growing power of the presidency on the one hand. The other is the growing personalization of that power on the other. And you saw that with respect to Donald Trump. He thought not only was the Justice Department an instrument of the executive branch, he thought it was an instrument of him personally. And I think that's what may, and Barr, I think, acceded to that view in many ways. And I think if there's anything that's unique or different about the Trump administrations and their way of thinking about the Justice Department, it's that.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. We're discussing the independence of the Attorney General's Office in the Department of Justice with Cornell Clayton of Washington State University. And certainly the fact that the Attorney General Sessions lost his job in part because of Trump's anger that he was not intervening in the Mueller investigation, fits that narrative.
Protecting him personally, yeah.
Exactly. But when Barr was asked to intervene on behalf of the president with respect to the election, Barr kind of drew a line in the sand and seemed to say, this only goes so far. Is it fair to say do you share that interpretation? Does that show that perhaps there is a limit to how much the president can try to use the attorney general to serve his, very specific interests?
I mean, I think in the end, Barr said, I'm only willing to go so far. Now, keep in mind, this is against the backdrop of what he did with the Mueller investigation, for instance, and, which was basically dramatically to protect Donald Trump. It's against the background of what he did with respect to, prosecutions against Michael Flynn and against Roger Stone. And so he went a long ways towards using his power to protect Donald Trump personally, as well as the Trump administration's policies. I think in the end, who knows what he had in his mind. I think he saw what Donald Trump was trying to do with the election was simply illegal. And so he was not willing to go that far, and he had his one foot out the door anyway. So does he get credit in the end? Yeah, I think he does. But again, I do think it's, I hate to put too much emphasis on these specific individuals who are in these offices. And I think it's much more important to put them in the historical context. The growing power of the presidency on the one hand, and the growing personalization of that power and independence that presidents have from their congressional parties. That's huge, I think, in understanding what happened with Trump.
Now, so last question, though, is since there clearly was a limit as to how much the president can use this office for his own personal gain, plus conversations like the one we're having here, do you see that this a potential backlash against this growing presidential power over the Department of Justice and calls for more of an independence? Do you think the trend is going to go towards even further co-optation of the Department of Justice for the president's interests? Or do you think there's a sense that President Trump exposed the challenge of an unchecked presidency when the Department of Justice can't check it, and that there's a need to rein in the presidency?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unclear what's going to happen in the future. I do think that the Biden administration are trying to reestablish norms of professional independence and autonomy at the Department of Justice. They've picked the perfect person to do that, Merrick Garland. But, you know, again, that's exactly what both Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter tried to do by appointing, you know, autonomous individuals to the head of the Department of Justice back then. And then as soon as you get a president who doesn't have that view, those norms get quickly reversed. That's the problem. Unless you have an effort to take on frontally this idea of the unitary executive theory and institute in law some kinds of protections for the Department of Justice, you know, norms are just norms and norms can change. And there's tremendous pressure. You know, again, I don't see how we're going to dramatically roll back executive branch power. And I don't see right now that we are going to change the way we elect officials in campaign finance reform. And so those two competing, those two pressures, you know, the growing power of the executive branch and the personalization of that power in the president himself and autonomy from Congress, those are going to be a problem in future presidents. And so the Department of Justice will be vulnerable to that kind of politicization again, if you want to put it in those terms, unless you have some kind of legal statutory reforms.
So we've been discussing the relationship between the Department of Justice and the presidency, questions of just how independent is or should the Department of Justice be, and the potential trends in addressing those questions. And we've been discussing this with our guest, Cornell Clayton, who is the C.O. Johnson Distinguished Professor of Government and the director of the Thomas S. Foley Institute for Public Policy and Public Service at Washington State University. He is the author of The Politics of Justice, Attorney Generals, and the Making of Government Legal Policy. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.